Hello, this is Robert Orme, broadcasting from the Audible Local Ledger, an affiliate station of the Massachusetts Radio Reading Service. Today I will be reading the Wednesday, July 10th, 2019 edition of the Fall River Herald. Water woes. Algae in South Watapa could pose health risks, business as usual at other beaches. By Peter Jasinski. City health officials are urging residents to avoid swimming in South Watapa Pond, as a potentially hazardous algae bloom discovered in the water last summer has yet to dissipate. According to a Monday email sent by Fall River Board of Health agent Tess Curran, swimming in the water is still considered unsafe for people and pets. The city's health department is also cautioning the public against drinking any water from the pond or letting pets near the water. Curran's message comes after a holiday weekend when temperatures climbed into the 80s and at the start of a week in which high temperatures were expected to reach close to 90 degrees. The city's health department issued a public advisory against swimming last July after the State Department of Public Health reported high algae levels in water samples taken from the pond. So-called blooms of blue-green algae were found in the water, which state officials said had been a result of hot weather and strong sunlight. The city has not banned swimming at South Watapa Pond outright, but is instead warning residents that coming into contact with the water could have negative health side effects. Contact with the water can cause skin and eye irritation. Ingestion can result in stomach aches, vomiting, and diarrhea. Inhaling water spray with high levels of blue-green algae can also cause asthma-like symptoms, according to the city. People exposed to the blue-green algae are urged to rinse off any part of them that came into contact with the water. City health officials recommend that anyone experiencing symptoms after contact seek medical attention. Animals exposed to the water could require veterinary care if they lick fur that has been contaminated with algae, according to health officials. As of Tuesday, no advisory had been issued against boating on the pond. Typical algae levels for a body of water such as South Watapa Pond are 70,000 cells per milliliter of water. Lab tests of water samples taken last summer showed the pond's algae presence had reached as high as 132,202 cells per milliliter of water. Toxic algae cells can accumulate in water when nearby foliage dies off under certain conditions. Blooms can also be caused by fertilizer runoff. Homes in Westport and Tiverton, which border the pond, rely on septic systems instead of municipal sewers. City officials said last year that a lack of steady rain had helped foster algae growth, because the water was not naturally flushing out materials that can cause algae blooms. Overall, Massachusetts has 529 public marine and 549 freshwater public beaches, the water quality of which is tracked by the State Department of Public Health. Department data as of Tuesday showed that swimming areas throughout Greater Fall River, tested weekly, are open. Those sites include Town Beach in Swansea, Pierce Beach in Somerset, and Horseneck, Cherry and Webb, and East Beaches in Westport. The Westport River, whose water quality levels are regularly monitored by Westport River Watershed Alliance, tested safe for swimming from north to south in its July 1st report. Cape Cod was on watch last week as red tide moved down from New Hampshire, leading to shellfish enclosures. The red tide algae can trigger a condition that can cause numbness of the lips, drowsiness, vomiting, respiratory arrest, and in some cases death if shellfish exposed to the tide are consumed in sufficient quantities. This year's bloom was aided by a wet May and June that washed nutrients into the sea to feed the algae, according to Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. FRPD Under Review by Peter Jasinski. Many of the city's elected officials and state legislators gathered Monday to sing the praises of the Fall River Police Department as part of an ongoing review to update the department's accreditation with the Commission on Accreditation for Law Enforcement. Participating auditors told the Herald News that the review process, which evaluates a department's best practices according to national standards, could touch upon the 15 criminal charges filed against suspended Fall River Police Officer Michael Pessoa. But one auditor said the focus will primarily be on the department's handling of the indictments. Jackie Boykin, a captain in the Knightdale, North Carolina Police Department, and one of the review's two auditors, said the inquiry would not delve into any specific ongoing investigations unless an allegation surfaces that officers were not following department policy. "Our job is to ensure they are following the best practices," Boykin said. "In a situation like Pessoa's, the best practice is ensuring there is due process for the officer and an investigation takes place. We may make an inquiry about the incident so far as to see if there is an investigation ongoing, but we would not get into the nitty-gritty of the incident or that officer himself." Pessoa, a 17-year veteran of the department, was suspended without pay June 27th, the same day he was indicted on felony charges, including aggravated assault and battery with a dangerous weapon, civil rights violations with bodily injury, witness intimidation, and filing false police reports. All 15 charges are connected to Pessoa's interactions with members of the public he allegedly assaulted while serving as a Fall River police officer. Despite the recent negative attention the department received, Monday's meeting, billed as an on-site assessment and public information session, was almost entirely devoted to praising the department's work within the community. Mayor Jaziel Correa, Representative Carol Fiola, Representative Alan Sylvia, and Fall River Public School Superintendent Matthew Malone spoke at length about how the department has gone above and beyond to foster positive relationships with city residents, students, and officials. The only speaker to mention any controversy was school committee member and mayoral candidate Paul Coogan, who alluded to the 2017 fatal police shooting of a 19-year-old man in the city's industrial park and a widely circulated video from the spring of two officers removing a student from Resiliency Preparatory Academy. Referring to the video, which attracted accusations of excessive force from some members of the public, Coogan said, "It got big play on YouTube. A little bubble up, but the officers were back at work the next day and the day after because they have that respect from the community." Coogan later added, "I think those two instances speak volumes to what's going on. Not just to the excellent leadership in the department, but the climate that's been created." Correa noted the growing stresses of serving as a police officer and complimented the city's law enforcement for promoting community policing. He specifically mentioned Project Reconnect, an ongoing initiative within the department that has officers regularly check in on city residents who have survived opioid overdoses. "All those things take creativity. They're not automatic. They aren't the average things every department does," Correa said. "I can't say enough good things. I could stay here all night and say more." The Fall River Police Department has been accredited through the Commission on Accreditation for Law Enforcement every 3 years since 2009 and, according to Department Accreditation Manager Sergeant J.T. Hoare, is one of three departments in Massachusetts accredited through the organization. It really just puts more trust in the police department because we're set to some standards that are nationally accredited, Hoare said. Policies and procedures are not only reviewed internally, but they're reviewed by an outside agency to confirm we're doing things consistently, each and every time. Hoare said accreditation would be especially beneficial if the department were ever sued. In any civil litigation, they look at the policies that were followed, Hoare said. If we were outside of those policies, then obviously there would be issues with liability there. But if you're within the four corners of that policy, then you're protected. As long as that officer followed those rules, they're usually pretty good. Monday's meeting was predominantly attended by city and elected officials, but some representatives of Fall River's various neighborhood groups were present. Maplewood neighborhood resident Earl Gaudette described the attentiveness of officers at community outreach meetings and complimented their willingness to work one-on-one with residents to address their concerns. "We're a close-knit neighborhood, but we accept them as one of our own. We love them as one of our own," he said of the city's officers. "There is never a problem in my community that has never been solved." Auditors reviewing the Fall River Police Department described Monday as one of the best-attended hearings they had seen. "The outpouring of support from every level of the community was impressive, very impressive," said Joseph Race, a police captain in Madison, Connecticut. The department's review was expected to conclude today. Summer Lectures Explore Peculiar Fall River History by Deborah Allard. There's no shortage of interesting Fall River history. Each year, Fall River Historical Society finds a few gems to present in its summer lecture series. This year's series was to kick off Tuesday night with River Rocks, Landmark Stones, and Stories by Bill Goncalo. "This should be very interesting," said Historical Society Assistant Curator Dennis Binet before the lecture. Goncalo planned to share his knowledge about local rocks and stones, some of which are things of legend. Topics were to include Profile Rock, which was recently destroyed, and the city's Rolling Rock, among others, and the downtown fire of 1928 that exposed the granite ledge. Three other lectures will be offered on consecutive Tuesdays this month. All will be held at Bristol Community College in Lecture Room C111, 6:30 p.m. The series is free, but donations will be accepted to support society programs. Binet said society members brainstorm interesting historical tidbits for the series each year to complement speakers' field of expertise. "Fortunately, there are a lot of people out there with lots of different interests," Binet said. "There's so much history in the city of Fall River, it just needs to be made public." On Tuesday, July 16th, downtown Fall River, from sleepy crossroads to bustling city center, will be presented by Bob Kitchen. The lecture will take listeners back to downtown's early days, and into its mid-20th century heyday, when the streets were filled with shops and pedestrians. "He's got some great illustrations," Binet said. History lovers will learn about murder on Tuesday, July 23rd, in South Coast 1826 through 2016, 190 years of murder and slaughter and mayhem, with Stephanie Corey. The talk will be based on findings of the three-volume series of the same name by John B. Red Cummings Jr. and Corey. The last lecture, "Could It Be That Fall River's Finest Year Was 1953? Let's See," by Philip Sylvia Jr., will explore the year before the city's 150th anniversary, and what it was like living during a time of civic pride, community spirit, and purpose. It's set for July 30th. Bennett said those attending the lectures should be prepared to arrive on time, or early. He said lectures were so well attended last summer that some people were turned away due to the room's seating capacity of 125. "We had record attendance last year," Bennett said. "My recommendation is, come early." To learn more, contact the Historical Society at 508-679-1071, extension 5. Hotel Demolition Work Begins by Kurt Brown. LaFrance Hospitality of Westport has begun demolition work for its new 90-room hotel on Old Bedford Road, next to its Hampton Inn, town officials said. Two commercial buildings on the property that will be replaced by the project, Gentle Touch Therapeutic Spa at 98 State Road, and Chase Grain at 105 State Road, were demolished within the last 2 weeks, according to Building Inspector Ralph Souza. The Westport Planning Board approved the site plan for the new hotel at a meeting on June 4th, according to Jim Hartnett, the town planner. The four-story hotel will be built north of the railroad tracks and will have frontage on Old Bedford Road and 113 parking spaces, he said. The hotel will face Interstate 195 and be of a similar style to the Hampton Inn. The rear of the property will face State Road. LaFrance Hospitality is also planning to construct a 50-foot by 80-foot storage building, as well as parking for another 131 vehicles, Hartnett said. The new hotel will be situated on a separate lot from the Hampton Inn, he said. Members of the LaFrance family and Tim Burkhart, vice president of hotels for LaFrance Hospitality, were not available for comment on Monday. The company is planning to build a Town Place Suites, an extended stay hotel, in association with Marriott, LaFrance family members said in May. LaFrance Hospitality has a Town Place Suites in Wareham and several other hotels with Marriott, the news story said. In Wareham, rooms feature pull-out sofas, a kitchen area with a stovetop, a microwave and apartment refrigerator, a desk, and a place to eat, as well as king and queen size beds. LaFrance family officials said they are hoping to attract more conferences to the area and its restaurants will provide the food for the hotels. LaFrance Hospitality also operates the Fairfield Inn and Suites by Marriott, an 82-room hotel on New Bedford's waterfront, and a Holiday Inn Express 117-room hotel on West Main Road in Middletown, Rhode Island, as well as hotels in Maine, New Hampshire, and Florida. State Police Plan Sobriety Checkpoint This Weekend by Linda Roy. Massachusetts State Police will be on the lookout for drunk drivers Friday and Saturday in Bristol County. A sobriety checkpoint will be operated during varied hours. The selection of vehicles will not be arbitrary. Safety will be assured. Any inconveniences to motorists will be minimized with advance notice to reduce fear and anxiety. Colonel Kerry A. Gilpin, superintendent of the Massachusetts State Police, announced that a sobriety checkpoint will be implemented by the Massachusetts State Police on a public way in Bristol County on Friday, July 12th, into Saturday, July 13th. The purpose is to further educate the motoring public and strengthen the public's awareness to the need of detecting and removing those motorists who operate under the influence of alcohol and/or drugs from roadways. The sobriety checkpoint is made possible by a grant from the Highway Safety Division of the Massachusetts Executive Office of Public Safety and Security. Galvin, Logistics in Way of Citizenship Question by Katie Lane. The chances of a citizenship question making its way onto next year's census forms appear low to Secretary of State William Galvin, who oversees the count for Massachusetts. During an appearance on WCVB's On the Record that aired Sunday, Galvin was asked for his take on the U.S. Supreme Court's June 27th ruling that blocked the Department of Commerce from asking about citizenship on the census unless officials return to the courts and provide a valid reason for including it. The logistics of printing the questionnaires in multiple languages for distribution across the whole country really is almost prohibited when it comes to the timeline, said Galvin, who has opposed the citizenship question and cheered the court's ruling. Basically, what the Supreme Court did is they remanded it back to the district court in New York, so the result is going to be more litigation. And as you know, President Trump tweeted something about delaying the whole census. I think that's not realistic. It's in the Constitution, and he can't suspend the Constitution. Speaking to reporters outside the White House on July 5th, President Donald Trump said he was exploring various ways to move forward with the citizenship question and thinking about issuing an executive order. We could also add an addition on so we can start the printing now and maybe do an addendum after we get a positive decision, Trump said. So we're working on a lot of things, including an executive order. Trump on Sunday said his administration was moving ahead with the census, and called the costs associated with it ridiculous. But they're spending $15 to $20 billion on a census, he said, according to a White House transcript. They're asking everything except, are you a citizen of the United States? How ridiculous is that? So we are moving forward. We have a couple of avenues. Galvin said he believed the question is intended to sabotage the census in states like ours. A Brighton Democrat who has overseen the last two census counts in Massachusetts, Galvin said statistical estimates show the state's population at about 6.9 million people. That's clearly enough people to justify the 9 seats in Congress that we now have, but if the count is badly flawed and we come in at substantially lower number than that, then it presents a problem, he said. The two big challenges Massachusetts confronts in getting an accurate count are its foreign-born and student populations, Galvin said. He said foreign-born residents, a group that he said includes naturalized citizens and green card holders, account for about 1 million people. The increase in our population over the last 10 years has largely been because of the foreign-born population that's come here, Galvin said. The second factor, though, which people overlook, is the students. Students should be counted here if they spend most of the year here. Galvin's office plans to conduct census outreach to seasonal populations this summer, informing them that their responses should be recorded where they live most of the time, according to a timeline on the secretary's website. Outreach to student populations is slated to begin in late August. Twin River Casino Blasts Rhode Island Lottery Deal by Catherine Gregg. A full-page ad in the Providence Journal on Sunday launched Twin River's campaign to convince Rhode Island lawmakers that the $1 billion, no-bid, 20-year lottery deal that Governor Gina Raimondo is pushing for international game technology will cost the state hundreds of millions of dollars in lost gambling revenue. If passed by lawmakers as proposed by Raimondo, the lottery would be required to get 85% of its 5,000-plus electronic gambling machines from IGT, even though state law currently caps the number at 50%. The company would potentially get a bigger slice of the revenue pie. And, as Twin River sees it, Rhode Island would lose the opportunity that other states, including Massachusetts, had to extract better deals from IGT by putting their contracts out to bid. "We think Rhode Island lawmakers should be terrified by this deal," marks Crisafulli, the executive vice president of Twin River Worldwide Holdings and president of the company's Rhode Island casino operations, told the Journal on Friday as the opposition campaign was about to launch. His argument: there's a potential $10 billion in state gambling revenue riding on the belief that the governor's office did this 20-year secret deal entirely correctly. That's a pretty big leap of faith when you consider the lack of process, the absence of any competition, the rushed nature of the deal, and the fact that the deal doesn't seem to make any business sense. There's no reason to do it now. The terms are very bad. It undermines competition. The response from IGT chairman Robert Vincent: to distill it down to, well, this is a no-bid contract for so many years, is wrong. This is an economic development package that contains agreements that, by and large, extend our existing relationship, in return for a commitment by IGT to protect 1,100 good-paying jobs in the state, as well as our presence in our downtown headquarters, and the ability to pitch us on any expansion plans we have going forward, Vincent said. And it's a good deal for the state, he said. That includes a $25 million upfront payment, added Raimondo spokesman Josh Block. The continuation of our partnership with IGT will result in hundreds of millions in local investment and jobs for 1,100 Rhode Islanders at an average salary of $100,000. IGT is one of only three companies in the world, and the only company in Rhode Island, capable of operating this system. And this agreement ensures Rhode Island employees will be guaranteed jobs for decades to come. Legislative leaders plan a special session sometime after Labor Day to consider the late-hatched IGT legislation that emerged the day before this year's legislative session ended. IGT essentially has two types of contracts with the state: one to run the central operating systems and the other to provide electronic gambling machines. Among Crisafulli's arguments against the proposed deal: IGT finished last in the competition for gambling dollars among the three companies that have video gaming machines at Twin River's state-run casinos in Lincoln and Tiverton. Over the last 12 months, he said, IGT's video slots were netting $258 from each machine each day, for an annual yield of $94,000. The state's share of that revenue, approximately $56,000. Some of the IGT-controlled machines are 10 years old or more, with names like Water Dragons, Funky Money, Elvira's Secret, and Kauai Cash, according to Twin River. By way of comparison, Every's machines averaged $303 per day per machine, which equates to about $110,000 annually per machine, with the state keeping about $66,000. The electronic gambling machines that Scientific Games provides average $401 per day per machine over the last 12 months. That translated into $146,000 annually from each machine. That puts the state's share at about $87,000 annually, according to Crisafulli. Put another way, the Rhode Island Lottery gets as much as $31,000 more annually from each of the other companies' machines. And on the systems side, the state is overpaying IGT at least $300 million over the 20-year extension, Crisafulli alleged. His number was based on a comparison between the 2.5%, worth about $12.5 million annually, the Rhode Island Lottery pays IGT to run the Video Central system, and the $23 million 10-year deal that Massachusetts struck with the company. Essentially, the state of Rhode Island is paying five times what Massachusetts is paying for the same, or at least a very similar system, he said, quoting from a press release on IGT's website. Why, he asked, would Rhode Island lock itself in for two decades in an increasingly competitive and changing market? The big concern is what is happening with the regional market right now. There are three new facilities in Massachusetts over the last couple of years. There's the prospect of a fourth, along with the prospect of a third facility in Connecticut. We are facing intense competition. Not only does this deal not help us to compete, it's a burden that makes us less competitive, he said. The Twin River ad reads, Last week, the day before the legislature ended, Governor Gina Raimondo announced a no-bid, 20-year, billion-dollar tentative agreement with lottery vendor IGT. This agreement has been negotiated in secret since January. The governor cannot sidestep Rhode Island's purchasing law. She cannot enter into a no-bid contract without a vote of the Rhode Island House and Senate. We believe that this agreement is not in the interest of the Rhode Island taxpayers. Over the next weeks, we will share our concerns and further explain why this is a bad idea. For Crisafulli, this is a turnabout. He was on the other side, negotiating for GTEC, the Rhode Island-based lottery company that merged with IGT. When the state agreed to the terms of the current 20-year no-bid deal that runs to 2023. In a telephone interview on Friday, Crisafulli said, It was a very different time and market, and that was a much better deal for the state. Building a building downtown was critical to kind of reinvigorating the downtown area, and that created all sorts of indirect value. This is Robert Orme, reading the Wednesday, July 10th, 2019 edition of the Fall River Herald, and I am at the halfway point of this broadcast. Albert J. Valancourt, 73, of Fall River, passed away Monday, July 8th, 2019. A teacher in the Catholic school system for 42 years, he was awarded the Catholic Teacher of the Year in Washington, D.C., and the Marion Medal. He leaves two sisters, Marcel and Jean de Cambra, both of Somerset, and many nieces, nephews, grandnieces, and grandnephews. He was the brother of the late Robert and Richard Valancourt, and the son of the late Philip and Jeanette A. Pellissier Valancourt. His funeral will be held Thursday at 11 a.m. at Holy Name Church. A visitation will be held prior in the church from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. Burial, Notre Dame Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, please consider a donation to the National Kidney Foundation, 209 West Central Street, Natick, Massachusetts, 01760. Online guestbook at auclairfuneralhome.com. Dorothy L. Sarmento Sosek, 84, of Seekonk, passed away June 28, 2019, at the Hebrew Rehabilitation Center at Newbridge on the Charles in Dedham. She was the wife of the late William T. Sosek. Born in Fall River, she was the daughter of the late Americo and Mary Mello Sarmento, and the sister of the late Teresa Sarmento. She is survived by her daughters, Andrea McLaughlin, husband Richard, of Attleboro, and Nancy Lamoureux, husband James, of Seekonk, her son, Thomas Sosek, wife Kimberly, of Walpole, and her grandchildren, Taylor, Ryan, Alyssa, Ashley, and Cole. Memorial visitation to which relatives and friends are invited will be held Friday, July 12, 2019, from 9 to 10 a.m. at Boyko Memorial Funeral Home, 709 Broadway, Fall River, Massachusetts, 02724, followed by a memorial mass at 11 a.m. at St. Stanislaus Church, Rockland Street, Fall River. Interment will be private. In lieu of flowers, donations in Dorothy's name can be made to the St. Vincent Children's Emergency Clothing Fund, 2425 Highland Avenue, Fall River, Massachusetts, 02720. www.boycomemorial.com. Rosemarie Sylvia Souza, 87, of Westport, passed away on Tuesday, July 9, 2019, at Catholic Memorial Home. She was the wife of the late Joseph B. Souza. Mrs. Souza was born in Fall River, daughter of the late Anton R. Sylvia Jr. and the late Rose L. Barbosa Sylvia, and had been a lifelong resident of Westport. Survivors include her two sons, Joseph B. Souza III and his wife Sharon of Warwick, Rhode Island, and James B. Souza and his wife Kathy of Dartmouth, four grandchildren, Jamie, Joseph IV, Cara, and Erica, three great-grandchildren, Braden, Jack, and Kaylee, along with several nieces and nephews. Mrs. Souza was predeceased by many brothers and sisters. Funeral to which relatives and friends are invited will be Saturday from the Potter Funeral Home, 81 Reed Road, Westport, at 8:30 a.m., followed by a mass of Christian burial at St. George Church, Westport, at 9:30 a.m. Calling hours will be Friday from 5 to 8 p.m. Interment will be in Notre Dame Cemetery, Fall River. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made to a charity of your choice. For directions or to sign the online guest book, please visit www.potterfuneralservice.com. Henry J. Red Partridge, 79, of Fall River, husband of the late Claudia A. Hadjder Partridge, passed away Tuesday, July 9, 2019. He was a U.S. Air Force veteran. He leaves four children, Keith Partridge and his wife Rhonda, Karen Nunez, Kevin Partridge and his wife Janet, and Kurt Partridge, seven grandchildren, Jennifer, Stephanie, and Jared Partridge, Derek Nunez, Kaylee Lamonth, and John and Nicholas Partridge, three great-grandchildren, Ethan, Andrew, and Logan, a sister, Kathleen A. Kathy Partridge, and many nieces and nephews. He was the father of the late Kenneth Partridge and the son of the late Henry J. and Lena Ference Partridge. His funeral will be held Friday at St. Bernard's Church at 10 a.m. Meet directly at church. Burial, St. Patrick's Cemetery. A visitation will be held Thursday from 4 p.m. to 8 p.m. at the Eau Claire Funeral Home, 690 South Main Street, Fall River. In lieu of flowers, please consider a donation to the Disabled American Veterans, 755 Pine Street, Fall River, Massachusetts, 02720. Online guestbook at AuClaireFuneralHome.com. Man Plummets Through Watchtower on Gooseberry Island by Linda Murphy. A walk on the beach led to a tower of terror for one man Monday night. Around sunset, Westport Fire Department crews rescued a man who plummeted 10 to 20 feet into the Gooseberry Island World War II watchtower. Westport Fire Department Deputy Chief Dan Baldwin said the man gained access to the interior of the tower through a small 1-foot by 3-foot opening about 10 feet off the ground. The steel plate had been removed from that area, and when he got inside the tower, he climbed to an unknown height when he slipped and fell, said Baldwin. The male, in his early 30s, appeared to have broken bones, but non-life-threatening injuries. He was transported to Rhode Island Hospital for treatment, said Baldwin. When crews arrived, the male was face down in the tower. It's fortified to keep people out, which makes it difficult for us to get in, said Baldwin. The gate is like a prison cell door that's been welded shut. The fire department crew eventually gained access through a steel plate covering up a small hole in the door that had been covered with dirt and a boulder. In the meantime, paramedics were able to begin initial treatment on the man by gaining access to the interior using ground ladders, said Baldwin. The call to the fire department came in at 8:32, and crews were there about 40 minutes. They got to the tower, connected to the parking area by a sandy and rocky path, and transported the victim using a John Deere Gator all-terrain vehicle equipped for EMS purposes. Baldwin said a group of friends who were with the man alerted a state worker who was closing the Gooseberry Island parking lot for the day. The worker contacted the police through a 911 call that was conveyed to the fire department. The World War II-era tower, which is covered with graffiti all the way to the top, is used today as a navigational landmark for local boaters, said Baldwin. Following this incident, he said the state would work to secure the building once again. Unhealthy debate? Some think Dems helping Trump by promising health care to migrants. By Mark Z. Baraback and Noam Levy. With a sharp left turn, Democrats are risking a backlash on an issue of raw emotional and political sensitivity. Providing government health care to millions of people in the country illegally. 10 of the party's nearly 24 presidential candidates stood on a debate stage last month and, without hesitation, raised their hands, pledging themselves to the policy shift. Most others in the field have also expressed their support. This is not about a handout, said South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg. This is an insurance program. We do ourselves no favor by having 11 million undocumented people in our country be unable to access health care. The promise was consistent with the prevailing sentiment of the party's liberal base. But some worry the candidates have staked themselves too far left, boosting President Trump's re-election prospects. There's the question of how you provide health care for citizens of the United States and how you provide health care for residents of the United States, said Peter D. Hart, a longtime Democratic pollster who sees an important distinction between the two. To make them equivalent is probably a position that is not going to sit well with the mainstream of the electorate, Hart said. Trump would certainly agree. The Democratic contestants hadn't even left the debate stage when he weighed in. How about taking care of American citizens first? Trump said on Twitter. Days later, he elaborated. We're going to stop it, he told reporters of the promise to expand coverage to undocumented migrants. But we may need an election to stop it. The debate over government health care for those in the U.S. illegally has long vexed policymakers, marrying fiscal concerns with the tensions surrounding immigration, both legal and illegal, and the demographic changes remaking the face of the country. In most states, undocumented immigrants are barred from government-subsidized health care programs such as Medicaid, the federal program for the poor and disabled. California is a notable exception. Since 2016, the state has provided Medicaid to children under 18, regardless of their immigration status. In its new budget, California goes even further by extending the program to low-income immigrants until they turn 26. The move has been largely greeted with a shrug. A March survey by the nonpartisan Public Policy Institute of California found nearly two-thirds of those surveyed supported Medicaid coverage for young adults without legal status. "We've gotten relatively little, if any, organized opposition," said Anthony Wright, executive director of the left-leaning advocacy group Health Access. He said the political hurdles faced in covering all undocumented migrants stemmed more from fiscal arguments than philosophical concerns. That accepting attitude, however, isn't widely shared. A CNN poll conducted after the Democratic debate found nearly 60% of those surveyed nationwide opposed government-provided health insurance for undocumented migrants. While liberal Democrats were strongly in favor, nearly two-thirds of independents were opposed, as were 61% of self-described moderates. Those, not incidentally, are the swing voters who tend to decide close elections. "Most Americans want to make sure that their candidate for president cares about what's good for the whole country, not just what's good for one subset of people," said Lena Erickson, a politics and policy analyst at Third Way, a center-left Washington think tank. Trump has consistently used the immigration issue to portray Democrats as weak on border security and more concerned with immigrants than the country as a whole, Erickson said, and candidates need to be careful they're not making his job easier. In crafting the Affordable Care Act, Democrats were acutely sensitive to the fraught politics surrounding immigration and health care. To defuse opposition, they included language barring undocumented immigrants from enrolling in insurance plans created by the law, even if they were able to pay the full cost. When President Barack Obama pitched the Affordable Care Act to Congress, he assured lawmakers the landmark legislation would exclude millions of people in the country illegally. "You lie," hollered Republican Representative Joe Wilson of South Carolina, a rejoinder that not only shredded protocol, but underlined the emotionalism surrounding the issue. Politics aside, advocates say there are practical reasons to extend health care coverage to every American, regardless of immigration status. Hospitals are obliged by federal law to offer emergency treatment to anyone who comes through the door, whatever their immigration status or ability to pay. Historically, that has placed a substantial burden on many urban providers of last resort, such as LA County USC Medical Center. "We already pay for the health care of undocumented immigrants," Julian Castro, one of the Democratic presidential hopefuls, noted on ABC. "It's called the emergency room." Beyond that fiscal reality, there are public safety considerations. Many physicians, hospital officials, and public health leaders say it makes little sense to deny coverage to undocumented immigrants, warning, for example, that infectious diseases may spread more quickly if people are discouraged from seeking medical care. Yet even as Democrats push for greater access to coverage, through Medicare for All or marketplaces created under the Affordable Care Act, Trump has moved in the opposite direction. Recently, the administration unveiled its so-called public charge regulation, which could deny green cards, a step toward citizenship, to immigrants who receive certain forms of government assistance, such as Medicaid. That further concerns public health officials and medical leaders who see immigrant parents foregoing health insurance for their children, even if their offspring are U.S. citizens, for fear that seeking care could jeopardize their chances of securing a green card. Some believe Trump's pugnacious policies and the humanitarian crisis on the border with Mexico have softened attitudes toward undocumented immigrants and made voters more sympathetic to their plight. Celinda Lake, a Democratic strategist who has done extensive research on healthcare issues, professed not to worry about a voter backlash, so long as presidential candidates make clear they're not just concerned about people in the country illegally. The biggest risk for Democrats is not being too liberal, but not talking about things that deliver for working and middle-class families, Lake said. The people in these debates were pretty good with a ready answer about, what are you going to do about health care for my family? The seesaw of dual addiction. Numbers rise for those on both meth and heroin. By April Dembowski. In the 25 years since she snorted her first line of meth at a club in San Francisco, Kim has redefined normal so many times. At first, she said, it seemed like meth brought her back to her true self, the person she was before her parents divorced and before her stepfather moved in. I felt normal when I first did it, like, oh, there I am, she said. Kim is 47 now, and she has been chasing normal her entire adult life. That chase has brought her to some dark places, so she asked us not to use her last name. For a long time, meth, also known as speed, was Kim's drug of choice. Then she added heroin to the mix. She tried it for the first time when she was in treatment for meth. That put me on a 9-year run of using heroin, and I thought, oh, heroin's great. I don't do speed anymore. To me, it saved me from the tweakerness, Kim said, referring to the agitation and paranoia many net meth users experience, and how heroin, an opiate, calmed that. Now, Kim has finished treatment for both drugs. Kim was part of the previous meth wave in the 90s, and now she's part of a new meth epidemic that has been sweeping through parts of the United States, especially the West. Deaths involving methamphetamine are up. Hospitalizations are up. Researchers who have tracked drug use for decades believe the new meth crisis got a kickstart from the opioid epidemic. There is absolutely an association, said Dr. Philip Coffin, director of substance use research at the San Francisco Department of Public Health. Across the country, more and more opioid users say they now use meth as well, up from 19% in 2011 to 34% in 2017, according to a study published last year in the journal Drug and Alcohol Dependence. The greatest increases were in the Western United States. That research suggests efforts to get doctors to cut down on writing opioid prescriptions may have driven some users to buy meth on the street instead. Methamphetamine served as an opioid substitute, provided a synergistic high, and balanced out the effects of opioids so one could function normally, the researchers wrote. It's kind of like having a cup of coffee in the morning to wake up, and a glass of wine in the evening to wind down, meth on Monday to get to work, heroin on Friday to ease into the weekend. Amelia said that's how her drug use evolved to include meth. She also asked that we use only her first name because she has used illegal substances. At first, drugs were just a fun thing to do on weekends, ecstasy and cocaine with her friends. Then on Monday, Amelia went about her work week. I'm a horse trainer, so I worked really hard, but I also partied really hard, she said. Then one weekend, when Amelia was feeling kind of hungover from the night before, a friend passed her a pipe. She said it was opium. I thought it was like smoking weed or hash, you know? I just thought it was like that, Amelia said. She grew to like the opium stuff. Eventually, Amelia met up with her friend's dealer. The woman said, "How long have you been doing heroin for?" And my jaw nearly hit the ground, Amelia said. I was just really, honestly shocked. I was like, what? I've been doing heroin this whole time? I felt really naive, really stupid for not even putting the two together. Pretty soon, Amelia started feeling sick around the same time every day. It was withdrawal symptoms, a clear sign she was becoming dependent on the drug. Her weekend smoke became her daily morning smoke. Then it was part of her lunch break routine. I just kind of surrendered to that and decided, screw it, she said. I'll just keep doing it. I'm obviously still working. I'm fine. A heroin habit is expensive. Amelia was working 6 days a week to pay for it. Any horses that needed to be ridden, any lessons that needed to be taught, she said yes because she wanted the money. But bankrolling her heroin habit was exhausting. One day, one of the women she worked with at the horse barn offered her some meth as a pick-me-up. Meth is comparatively cheap. It became the thing that kept Amelia going so she could earn enough money to buy heroin. The heroin was the most expensive part, she said. That was $200 a day at one point. And the meth was $150 a week. This pattern lasted for 3 years, until Amelia discovered she was pregnant. As soon as her daughter was born, she entered a residential treatment program in San Francisco, called the Epiphany Center, that would accept her and her baby. I was okay with being a drug addict. I was okay with that being my life, she said. But I wasn't okay with having kids and letting that be part of my life. Admissions to drug rehabilitation for heroin have remained steady in recent years in San Francisco, but the number of heroin addicts reporting methamphetamine as a secondary substance problem has been rising. In 2014, 14% of heroin users said meth was also a problem. 3 years later, 22% said so. That is very high, said Dr. Dan Ciceroni, a physician and professor at the University of California, San Francisco, who has been studying heroin for almost 20 years. That's alarming and new and intriguing and needs to be explored. The speedball, heroin and cocaine, is a classic combination, he said. It's like peanut butter cups, right? Chocolate and peanut butter together, he said. Methamphetamine and heroin are an unusual combination. The meth and heroin combo is referred to as a goofball, Ciceroni added, because it makes the user feel a little bit silly and a little bit blissful. For Kim, adding heroin to her methamphetamine habit compounded her use. I ended up doing both, at the same time, every day, both of them, she said. It was all about finding the recipe to what felt normal. Start with meth, add some heroin, touch up the speed. You're like a chemist with your own body, she said. You're balancing, trying to figure out your own prescription to how to make you feel good. Now Kim is trying to find balance without drugs. She's been sober for a year. So is Amelia, the horse trainer. Her sobriety anniversary is her daughter's birthday. Tour de France. Viviani wins Stage 4. Elia Viviani had left the Giro d'Italia utterly disappointed. 2 months later, the Italian rider left bitterness and his sprinting rivals in his wake to claim his first career stage win in the Tour de France after storming a bunch sprint on Tuesday with an impressive display of power and speed. The 30-year-old track specialist, arguably the fastest man in the peloton this season, had left his home race empty-handed in May under controversial circumstances. Viviani, who has now posted stage wins at all three Grand Tours, was stripped of a victory in Italy after the race jury ruled he had irregularly changed his line and blocked an opponent in the sprint. There was no such hiccup on the finish line in the eastern city of Nancy, and Viviani was clearly the best. The 2016 Omnium Olympic champion was ideally set up by the Dusinec Quick-Step lead-out train in the finale, and made the most of the slight uphill finish to prevail. Viviani edged Alexander Kristoff and Caleb Ewan, claiming the fourth stage of the three-week race. And we are at the end of our hour. This has been Robert Orr, reading the Wednesday, July 10th, 2019 edition of the Fall River Herald. I would like to remind you of our telephone number, 508-539-2030, to call us with comments, questions, and suggestions. Have a great day, and thanks for listening.